Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, May 13, 2016. Several youth are freed in Mundri after spending months in detention.
We are here today to release prisoners of war, 17 of them, based on the amnesty that the prison gives us to offer all those who took arms against the government because the peace has been signed. There's no need for us to keep those who are captured during the crisis.
And the South Sudan government begins to implement a new law to regulate the work of non-governmental organizations operating in South Sudan.
What usually happens to the people that do not cooperate with the law? This is not my law. It's not their law. It's the law of South Sudan. So if they don't meet requirements, they are not registered, period. They must meet the requirement to be registered.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The South Sudan Army in Amadi State released 17 youths who have been under detention for more than 6 months for alleged ties to the SPLA in opposition. The youth were arrested and detained following clashes that broke out in May of last year between cattle herders and local vigilante group in Amadi State. Gift Friday has more for VOA from Juba.
The youth were handed over to Amadi State officials who released the young men to the custody of their families. Acting Governor of Amadi State, Manasseh Duboy, says most of the youth were arrested in Mundri, Mundri Town, and along the Mundri-Bangalo Road between November and January. Duboy says military intelligence officers freed the men after talks between state authorities and SPLA Division 6 Commander William Manyang.
Good morning, we are in the SPLA barracks and we are here today to release prisoners of war, 17 of them, based on the amnesty that the prison gives us to offer all those who took arms against the government because the peace has been signed. There's no need for us to keep those who are captured during the crisis.
Duboy says the men aged 22 to 35 were released unconditionally without any charge. Michael Paul, one of the freed youth who spent 5 months in detention, could not hide his joy. Speaking in Arabic, Paul says his release is the beginning of a new chapter in his life.
Today we are happy because the deputy governor came together with the speaker of the state parliament. What is gone is gone. We thank them so much because there are no more bad things happening. We are for good things.
Bashir John was also freed today after spending 5 months in military detention. He says security forces arrested him after security agents suspected he was a member of the Nyarango vigilante group.
I am now happy that we are out of prison. We cannot think of the bad things we experienced anymore. The suffering we underwent is in the past because we are going to begin a new life.
Acting Governor Duboy urged parents of the young men to take care of their sons, but also encouraged them to promote peace in their communities.
They need to have proper care because some of them sustain wounds during the crisis, and then we need also to care of them, and then our objective is peace, our objective is development. So this is our message. We need people to move freely. We need new development. We don't want to remember the past. We need to open new page.
Amadi State Assembly Speaker Margaret Fozia says the military authorities' decision to free the youth proves the government is committed to achieving everlasting peace across South Sudan. Fozia urged the people of Amadi State not to listen to rumors and gossip.
So all the people of Amadi State, wherever they are, my message to them is let us work for peace and unity in our state. Let us not use divisive words to divide our people more, but let us use words that will unite us as people of Amadi. And the word that will unite us is peace, love, forgiveness, and harmony in our state. And we put our hands together to bring whatever resources we have to build Amadi.
Fozia says the government has begun to engage area youth, women groups and chiefs with meetings on peace and reconciliation as a strategy to reconcile and encourage peaceful coexistence. Egri Idri, a member of the SPLM-IO who represents Mundri in the Transitional National Assembly, thanked the government for releasing the men.
We appreciate the government for having responded positively to our demand that the arrest of people at this stage is not good, and we urge them to continue with this spirit. That is the spirit of peace that we look forward to. Let us forget the bitterness of the war, and let us stop insulting ourselves, and let us all forge towards development in our area.
Idri says military authorities are still detaining many youth who were arrested since June 2014. He urged government officials to order the release of all remaining youth immediately. Gift Friday for VOA News, Juba.
The International Human Rights Organization, Amnesty International, is calling on the South Sudan government to release or charge in court dozens of men being detained by the National Security Service. In a statement released yesterday, Amnesty International says more than 30 men are being arbitrarily detained at the National Security Service headquarters at the Jebel neighborhood in Juba. Elizabeth Deng is Amnesty International's researcher for South Sudan.
These 33 men have not been charged. They have not been presented in court. And we are calling on the National Security Service to release them immediately or to charge them and present them in court.
Deng says her organization is particularly concerned about Christopher Bwagbe, an Episcopal Church priest in his late 60s, affiliated with Charismatic Episcopal Church, who has been denied family visits since November of 2015.
We have come to learn that he has high blood pressure and his health is deteriorating, in part due to the conditions of detention, which are poor. The prison facility used by the NSS does not have adequate ventilation. The windows are tiny. The prisoners are fed only once a day and only beans and grains. They also do not have adequate bedding. So we are calling on the National Security Service to release Christopher Gwagwe as well as the other detainees they are holding.
Deng says Gwagwe is accused of having communicated with Alfred Lado Gore, the deputy chairperson of the SPLM-IO, who last month was sworn in as the Minister of Interior in the Transitional Government of National Unity. Deng says the peace agreement provides that individuals detained in association with conflict should be released.
We are calling on the government to implement this provision of the peace agreement, and we want to raise that, you know, the ridiculousness of the fact that he remains in national security detention while the person he's accused of communicating with is actually part of the government. Meanwhile, he has not actually been charged with any offense.
That was Elizabeth Deng, Amnesty International researcher for South Sudan. Queen Makalele contributed to this report from Nairobi. Government officials with representatives of... Government officials met with representatives of non-governmental organizations to explain the new requirement and procedures, which include mandatory registration of all aid agencies operating in South Sudan. The new requirement is stipulated in the Non-Governmental Organization Bill, which was passed into law by South Sudan National Parliament last year. NGO officials say parts of the new law hamper their ability to help the people of South Sudan who are in desperate need of food, shelter, and medical care. For VOA News, Waki Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
South Sudan Relief and Rehabilitation Commission officials today gave NGO officials copies of documents detailing registration and labor procedures as required by the new law. The documents also mandate how NGOs must obtain work permits for their workers. Deng Tong Kenjok is the NGO registrar at the South Sudan Relief and Rehabilitation Commission.
These are procedures of the act that we need to give to our partners so that they can read and then come prepared for the registration of their respective NGOs.
Kenjok says the NGOs are expected to familiarize themselves with the new requirements and will be expected to implement them by June 1st. He says the law requires that if NGOs do not complete registration certificates on time, they could face suspension of their operations in the country. The new law also requires that NGOs submit their proposed budgets, a one-year plan including areas they intend to operate in the country, and their sources of funding to the Relief and Rehabilitation Commission. In addition, the NGOs must provide the names and titles of national and international staff to the government. Kenjok says the government expects NGOs to respect the new law.
What usually happens to the people that do not cooperate with the law? This is not my law. It's not their law. It's the law of South Sudan. So if they don't meet requirements, they are not registered, period. They must meet the requirement to be registered. Then we are implementing the law. So that's why we give them a period to go over the document, to prepare themselves. By the time they come, they are registered. They either meet the requirements or they don't meet requirements.
South Sudanese lawmakers passed the NGO bill last year, which President Salva Kiir signed into law in February this year. Civil society activists and local and international NGOs operating in the country have widely criticized the bill. Kenjok says implementing the law will help eliminate what government officials call briefcase organizations, which he says are unable to effectively deliver services to South Sudanese. Most international non-governmental organizations employ foreign workers, including unskilled staff. South Sudanese have long complained that NGOs operating in the country favor foreigners during screening for employment. Some NGO top managers dismissed the charge and maintained that NGOs have difficulties getting qualified South Sudanese in the country. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
The Committee Against Torture is presenting its concluding observations on all countries reviewed at its last session. This includes Saudi Arabia and Turkey. Lisa Schlein has the story for VOA from Geneva.
In its examination of Turkey, the UN Committee Against Torture did not find torture to be widespread or systematic. Nevertheless, it noted torture continues to be practiced. The committee of 10 independent experts said its major concerns included impunity for acts of torture, inhumane detention conditions, and accusations of extrajudicial killings. Human rights expert Alessio Bruni says the committee has received many reports of authorities carrying out extrajudicial killings of civilians. These reportedly occurred while state security forces conducted counterterrorism operations in southeastern Turkey near the border with Syria.
The borders are, I would say, almost closed, and there are many fights, armed conflicts going on, and we received many allegations of civil population killed because it was in the mix of the fire and without any protection.
The committee called for a prompt, impartial, and effective investigation into these alleged killings. The panel also expressed concern about expulsion, return, or deportation of asylum seekers and refugees in violation of the 1951 Refugee Convention. Saudi Arabia also came in for criticism in regard to laws and practices that the committee says amount to torture. Independent expert Felice Geer says the committee finds the imposition of corporal punishment to be an area of particular concern.
It explicitly called for the state to put an immediate end to the practices of flogging and lashing and amputation of limbs and any other form of corporal punishment, and that these should be abolished.
The committee also called for a moratorium on the death penalty, noting its concern at Saudi Arabia's growing number of executions. Amnesty International reports Saudi authorities executed at least 158 people in 2015. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, economic experts meet in Rwanda to discuss opportunities in Africa. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today,
What core value do you live by?
I do value my education a lot because I know that with education I can go anywhere. I can explore the world. I can be whoever I want to be. I can go anywhere. I can do anything I want in life.
I live by the hard working as the core value and prioritizing the priorities. I like it just because when I live in hard working, I know for sure one day I might achieve something which I need in life.
It's respect. I love to be respected and I love to respect other people.
Okay, trust. So I love like someone I can trust. So I want someone to trust me because that's the way to go. Because if you don't trust someone, then there's nothing, there's no way you can go forward with it.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. The Economic Forum on Africa is being held this week in the Rwandan capital, Kigali. Over 1,200 political and business leaders are attending. Rwandan President Paul Kagame took part in a roundtable discussion on aid and investment. He said his decision to run for a third term was based on the demands of his people, although he thought about retiring.
I didn't ask for this thing at all. I was actually trying to tell my people that, you know what, there is room, you can find somebody else. Maybe you need to take a risk and look for somebody else. You are saying you can't let me go, you want me to stay because, you know, whatever the results we have had in the past. And I kept saying, no, we are not ready to take risks. We want you to stay. I said, but I'm having difficulties staying, and anyway, people outside have difficulties with me staying. So about thinking about that, they would say, well, but those same people from outside, when the country was on fire, burning almost to extinction, these fellows were just, in the end, it was like I was put in a cage. It's like, are you running away from this, or are you staying with us? So the debate was very healthy, and that's what it is, and maybe... Well, this is damned if we do, damned if we don't.
Agreeing with Mr. Kagame's decision on re-election is businessman and philanthropist Howard Buffett. His foundation has invested more than $500 million in Rwanda. He said investors want peace and stability as well as legal system that prosecutes corruption. Buffett, the son of a billionaire, Warren Buffett, said the Rwandan people voted to change the constitution to allow Mr. Kagame to seek another term. He said President Kagame has his confidence and his support during a third term.
The bottom line is that if we didn't think President Kagame was going to be here for another 7 years, we wouldn't even consider doing what we're trying to do. That's the bottom line. And every democracy goes through challenges and changes. I mean, we've got 27 amendments to our constitution. Constitutions can be amended. And I think what Rwanda did in this case, driven not by the president, but driven by almost a third of the country in petitions, I mean, in making a very strong statement about how they felt about their future. So, you know, I think about it in terms of, let's look at the results. The substance is that in 1994, the World Food Program estimated there were 800,000 people that were probably not going to survive without significant and quick food aid. Today, this country has pulled 3.5 million or more people out of poverty. That's substance, okay? So when I look at the results, I see no other answer other than this is what Rwandans want. They have proven it. They've done it themselves. They've made the statement, and there's a reason they've done it.
One of Buffett's next ideas for Rwanda is an agricultural institute. Inspired by the U.S. system of agricultural universities began over 150 years ago, the institute would focus on education, research, and extension services to farmers.
The institute we want to build, it's not a university. It's a practical agricultural institute, which means that everybody that comes out of that institute will apply what they've learned in some form or another in this country in agriculture. And it could be in processing. It could be in agribusiness. But it could be on the farm. And it could be that, you know, you train mechanics and you train people how to use equipment. And you train them different farming techniques. I mean, it's across the board. But that hasn't been done in a country that I'm aware of in the way that we're thinking of doing it. It's a big undertaking. I mean, but if there's one place we can do it, it's in Rwanda.
Mr. Kagame said partnership with investors and donors are important for economic development, but foreign partners often put conditions on the support they give. The Rwandan president said Africans want greater ownership of development projects. That means a bigger say on how to use assistance. But he added that Rwanda and its partners can monitor whether resources are being used properly and evaluate if projects are meeting expectations. Now we'll move to Sudan, where Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir returned home from Uganda late yesterday after attending Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni's controversial inauguration. Mr. Bashir is wanted by the International Criminal Court, and Uganda's failure to arrest him has sparked outrage. Elizabeth Pollard reports from Kampala.
Uganda greeted Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir with flowers, according to local media, after his plane arrived in Kampala Thursday for the inauguration of longtime President Yoweri Museveni. The Sudanese community in Uganda reacted with shock. Bashir has been wanted since 2009 by the International Criminal Court on charges of crimes against humanity, war crimes, and genocide in Sudan's Darfur region. This man fled to Kampala from Darfur that same year.
It was sad, actually. It was sad, like you see him just moving free. But again, at the end of the day, even if, like, the scenario like Bashir in Hague, what about the people in the IDP camp? Like, you talk to them as, like, you know what? Yeah, it's good to see Bashir behind bars. But again, what about the people who lost their lives? I mean, what about the people who lost their houses?
The conflict in Darfur, which began in 2003, is still considered ongoing, with humanitarian organizations often barred from the region. Bashir has continued to travel freely around parts of Africa, riding a swell of defiance vis-a-vis the ICC among some leaders. Western diplomats walked out of Museveni's inauguration Thursday as the Ugandan leader railed against the court, calling it useless in his speech. The U.S. State Department said the walkout, which included the American delegation, was an appropriate reaction. Uganda is a signatory of the Rome Statute, meaning it is obligated to arrest those wanted by the ICC. Mossad Mohammed Ali is the executive director with the African Center for Justice and Peace Studies in Kampala.
During the different African Union summit, you know, as they talk a lot about the withdrawal from the ICC. Yeah. Although, as you mentioned, you know, before, Uganda is one of the big supporters, you know, to the ICC. Even, you know, he asked for the cooperation of the ICC in order to investigate, even, you know, the crimes that have been committed here in Uganda, you know, by Alaria and others. However, now we witness, you know, this change, you know, in the different positions of the different leaders. And now it's mostly seen, you know, by his statement yesterday morning.
South Africa came under fire last June for allowing Bashir to leave the country during an AU summit there, despite a South African court order to arrest him. Lisbeth Pola for VOA News, Kampala.
We now move to Kenya, where despite calls to reconsider, the Kenyan government has said it will go ahead with plans to shut down its two large refugee camps, Kakuma and Dadaab. The president of the International Rescue Committee met with journalists in Kenya Thursday to discuss his recent visit to the camps and discuss the challenges facing the government and refugees alike. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
The majority of the world's refugees live in Africa, and there is a need for a new deal when it comes to their interests, said International Rescue Committee President David Miliband Thursday.
In fact, we don't think the debate should be for or against camps. The issue is finding something better than camps for the long-term displaced.
The Kenyan government announced this week it will go ahead with plans to close the Dadaab and Kakuma camps within the shortest time possible. Kenya hosts more than 500,000 refugees, with about 3/4 from Somalia and most of the others from South Sudan. Conflict continues in both countries. The Dadaab refugee camp was opened in 1991. About 100,000 of Dadaab's current residents were born there and do not know any other place, Miliband said. Miliband added that although the headlines are filled with stories from the European or Middle Eastern refugee crises, it is important not to overlook what he called the neglected crises on the African continent.
I think in thinking about the future, it's vital to start with the fact that Kenya has shown extraordinary fortitude and resilience in the face of successive refugee flows. The recent government statements reflect understandable frustration at the international community's laid-back attitude to Kenya's role as a refugee-hosting country.
Miliband also noted that conflicts in the Middle East have further squeezed international aid budgets. Kenya's Interior Ministry says al-Shabaab terrorists have used the Dadaab camp, home to an estimated 328,000 Somali refugees, to plan and train for attacks, like the one at Nairobi's Westgate Mall, where 67 people were killed in September 2013. Somalia's foreign ministry disputes that claim and says closing the camps will amplify security threats in the region and that extremists could take advantage of rootless young people, either by harming or recruiting them. Kenya has threatened to close the refugee camps in the past, most recently in 2015 and 2013, but never followed through. The United Nations has expressed profound concern about the government's plans. In a statement this week, the UN said the safety of hundreds of thousands of refugees hinges on Kenya's generosity. Kenya's government acknowledged that the closures will bring harm to the refugees and says the international community must take steps to minimize their pain and suffering. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
That's the end of our show for this Friday. We now leave you with M.E.J. Yore, who sings in his native Zande language about problems of in-laws. been listening to music from Emmy J singing about the problems with in-laws. I'm John Tanza in Washington. You have a safe weekend. Join us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.